Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. A companion film to Ken Burns' The American Bison series follows the return of bison to indigenous land.
It kind of, those moments where it kind of hits you and you're like, wow, I'm watching history.
Mike Rowe of the Discovery Channel's Dirty Job fame recently spoke at Casper College to talk about the importance of trade jobs.
How could I say no to Wyoming? It's one of my favorite places.
Farmers and ranchers face a lot of outside pressure, from the high price of hay to the allure of early retirement.
We could sell it for $10,000 an acre, if not more, probably more. But I don't want to sell it.
Why some cattle producers are choosing to keep their lands working. And we learn more about the new season of our podcast, The Modern West. Those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. Our region is losing millions of acres of agricultural land to development, and those trends may continue as land prices keep rising. Wyoming Public Radio's Will Walkie reports on some ranchers who could make a fortune by selling their land, but are choosing not to.
Shalise Harrison is driving around Wapiti, a small town on the doorstep of Yellowstone National Park. Several home construction sites and for sale signs line the highway.
This area right here used to be just one or two big ranches, and now they've split up into 20-acre parcels or less, and they're building these mansions.
Property values in this county jumped 16% last year and 24% the year before that. Like a lot of housing markets in the West, demand is outpacing supply. Harrison says rapid growth can affect the community in many ways, from changing the culture, to boosting property taxes, to shifting wildlife migration.
You have fences, you have noise, like we're driving down this road right now. And there is a certain tolerance that animals can handle, but in general, like what you're doing is changing a landscape to a different type of use.
Harrison is with the Western Landowners Alliance, which supports working farms and ranches. She says there's a lot of value in maintaining open landscapes. But working lands are disappearing. Last year, Wyoming lost 500,000 acres of farmland, and about 7 million acres were lost in the Mountain West over the past decade. Priscilla Bell is sipping coffee next to cattle corrals at her ranch near Wapiti. She says very few people can make a living only through agriculture here, in part because it's hard work.
Most of our vehicles have close to 300,000 miles on them. That doesn't bother me. Mm-hmm. Yes, I would like to have more money just because. I'd like to know what that felt like once, but it is what it is.
How does the ranch feel the pressure? Mostly the high price of gas, equipment, and hay, says her husband Matt Bell.
You got to be able to keep up with the prices. And right now, we just don't get enough for what we sell.
But they still want to keep working, even though they could easily retire if they sold their land to a corporation or developer.
Yeah, we could sell this 70 acres over here and then have somebody come in that wants to subdivide it. And we could sell it for $10,000 an acre, if not more, probably more. But I don't want to sell it.
Why not?
I don't want
to
see more
houses. Because we don't want to be a hypocrite. We don't want to cuss the damn development and then turn around and sell.
And do it.
And then, but... You know, I see why people are doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Because
they
get tired of the battle, because it's a constant battle.
So the Bells want to make sure the land doesn't get subdivided. They've considered conservation easements or trusts. Also, they don't have any kids, so they plan to pass the land down to someone who works for them and who also dislikes development. For ranchers and farmers and other families, that process can get complicated. Jack Cobb ranches in a town called Savory near the Colorado border. It has about 34 residents. Cobb's property is on its seventh generation, which means there are a lot of relatives and not everyone likes raising cows. These situations can end up in lawsuits, especially when the land is worth tens of millions of dollars.
Because we always talked about the three-generational rule. I mean, the first one builds it, the second one kind of builds it a little bit better, the third one comes along, has no idea what it took to build it, and then they lose it.
Cobb's whole family sat down a few years ago to talk about what to do, and everybody wanted the same thing, to create a dynasty trust meaning nobody can break off and sell. Everybody gave up their right to cash out, and that kept the land intact. Most of Cobb's relatives still live in town. He says keeping the land and family together is priceless.
I'm down at my nephew's birthday party, and everybody's there, and I told my wife and my kids, I said, put a price on this. You don't have enough zeros behind that dollar to take this away.
For other ranchers, the right financial decision might be to sell to the highest bidder. But some landowners are staying put, maybe because of stubbornness or for the love of their neighbors and families. Or maybe because they don't know of another way to live their lives. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Will Walkie.
Nationwide, millions of barriers like dams are plugging up rivers and streams, and that makes it hard for fish to move freely and lay their eggs. Now, the federal government is spending more than $200 million to reopen spawning grounds for fish. That includes an effort to recover an endangered species that's sacred to the Pyramid Lake Paiute tribe in Nevada. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Raydell reports.
At the Pyramid Lake Paiute Reservation in northern Nevada, rolling mountains cloaked in pale green sagebrush unfold for miles like a painting that never ends. Standing at an overlook in these hills is the tribe's chairman, James Phoenix. He's watching the Truckee River rush over Numana Dam, an irrigation diversion. As a kid, Phoenix fished in these waters for kiwi, suckerfish that aren't found anywhere else in the world.
Bringing them to shore and then cutting and filleting them, that was what my dad had taught me, and I got to experience, you know, that's how he was taught when he was young.
The tribe refers to themselves as Kwiwi Tekuta in their native language, which means the Kwiwi Eaters. But tribal members stopped catching them back in the 1980s as the fish population plummeted. A big reason for the decreased fish population is this dam. It was built more than 100 years ago to divert river water to the reservation for farming and ranching. But it's been a barrier for migration of the endangered Kwiwi and threatened Lahontan cutthroat trout, another fish crucial to the tribe. Phoenix says the previous tribal council discussed removing or modifying the dam, but kept running into the same hurdle.
A lot of funds weren't available.
That finally changed. The tribe is getting more than $8 million from the bipartisan infrastructure law to modify the dam. The money will be used to build a large underwater ramp, stretching from bank to bank, so fish can swim up and over the dam. The project, which recently broke ground, will reopen 65 miles of river for their migration. Phoenix says that will impact more than the tribe's culture.
It's important to our economics. You know, we rely on tourism and fishing, so we get a lot of anglers that are coming in seasonally, so it's really big for us.
Shiva Sundaresan is deputy director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and attended the project's groundbreaking. He says dams aren't the only obstacles fish populations like kwiwi and Lahontan cutthroat trout have to overcome.
As climate changes in places, we're seeing changes in snowpack, changes in the timing of when you have snow melt, changing water temperatures. All of that is definitely affecting fish populations, fish habitat.
He says that's why the Fish Passage Project at Numana Dam is one of dozens nationwide receiving federal funding. Others in our region include efforts to recover Yellowstone cutthroat in Idaho, Rio Grande cutthroat in New Mexico, Bear River cutthroat in Wyoming and Utah, and Flannelmouth sucker in Utah. Projects include everything from removing old dams to installing new culverts, which are large pipes that pass streams beneath roadways.
The more I think we can restore these ecosystems, allow fish to migrate up and down the streams, have habitat where they can find refuge when, you know, water temperatures rise, the better we will be at protecting and restoring, conserving these fish populations.
At the Pyramid Lake Paiute Reservation, the underwater ramp will allow up to 600,000 kwiwi to swim over the diversion dam to new spawning grounds. Lisa Hakey is a Reno-based project leader with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Historically, they move in large numbers at the same time and they back up behind this current design. Now with this gradient structure downstream, it's designed specifically for kwiwi swimming capacity and speed.
She says when river flows go down this fall, construction of the ramp will speed up. The tribe is putting the project out for a construction bid, and a third-party contractor will build it. Tribal Chairman Phoenix says the Pyramid Lake Paiute Tribe is excited to finally see shovels break ground on a decades-long effort to recover their native fish.
It's historical, it's big for us, and it's part of our existence. You know, it signifies us as Numu people here at the Pyramid Lake Paiute Tribe.
He adds he's looking forward to the day when the Kwiwi population is big enough for tribal members to catch, fillet, and eat them once again. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Caleb Radel.
Stay with us to hear an interview with the director of a documentary focused on returning bison to indigenous lands. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. Juliana Branham is a documentary filmmaker and citizen of the Comanche Nation. She is the director of the new PBS short film Homecoming that tells the story of the return of bison to indigenous lands. The film is a companion to the recent Ken Burns documentary, The American Buffalo, which Branham worked on as a consulting producer as well. Wyoming Public Radio's Hanna Haberman spoke with the director.
Juliana, thank you so much for being here today. What is your personal relationship to bison, and how did that connection shape the way you approached making this film?
My relationship to bison really comes from being a Comanche person, a citizen of the Comanche Nation, and we were one of the main buffalo tribes on the Southern Plains. We were traders of buffalo, hunters. They were a part of our spiritual and cultural ways. For me, we were in a time for so long where the buffalo went away. We did have the preserve here in Oklahoma where I live, the Wichita Mountains Preserve, right next to our tribal headquarters. And so we would see them often, but we always knew that it was an animal that was important to us and our identity, and that it had gone away. And so my great aunt grew up at a time where they had no buffalo at all. And so we always kind of knew from her that the beef that we would eat and that she would hang up to dry like her mother and father had done before her, that wasn't our meat. Like that wasn't the meat that we were supposed to be eating, but that was what we had to eat. We really just saw the animal as kind of like, you know, like a zoo almost. We would get to drive through the mountains there and stop off on the side of the road and watch them from afar. And now with all the work that the Intertribal Buffalo Council does to return them to tribal lands, we're seeing more and more of that introduced back into our diets, which I think is a really incredible thing to witness. I think it goes without saying that in order for a culture to be healthy, the people have to be healthy. And buffalo is probably the healthiest meat you can have.
So you mentioned the Intertribal Buffalo Council, and this film highlights the work of Eastern Shoshone tribal member Jason Valdez and the Intertribal Buffalo Council as they are working to return bison to different indigenous lands. Can you share a little bit about what this work of rematriation looks like on the ground and how it benefits Native communities and ecosystems?
It's a lot of hustling, basically. You know, he spends a lot of time in Washington, D.C., where he has to lobby with the government to try to figure out basic things like how to get the USDA to inspect their meat, because the tribe is a sovereign nation. It's all brand new. Like we have to come up with these new processes. And so he's lobbying there. And also it's a lot of fundraising to be able to buy land for these tribes to be able to have their own herds. You have to have the infrastructure in place. To me, it seems like the most challenging thing is land. So for instance, my tribe, we don't have a reservation, and from the Dawes Act, our land is kind of checkerboarded, so we don't necessarily have enough land to have a large herd. And we're seeing all these other tribes like in the Pacific Northwest that probably didn't have, or, you know, even in the Northeast that didn't rely on buffalo in the past, but have their own herds now because they were able to have the land base to do that.
For you as a filmmaker, what were some particularly powerful or memorable moments from the process of making Homecoming that really stand out to you?
It was fast and furious because you only have a day to pick up the animals really early in the morning and then transport them somewhere. Otherwise, you know, they can't go spend the night somewhere. You have to get them. You have to drive all day nonstop, you know, fast bathroom break, and then you're back on the road and get them to their location so they're not stressed. Probably the most exciting for me was when we brought a small herd of buffalo to the Menominee Reservation in Wisconsin. We brought them from the Nachusa grasslands in Illinois. They had worked so hard to get the fence up in time, to make sure they had everything they needed. It had been kind of snowing and we were trying to get there before, you know, a storm was to hit, and everybody was just chomping at the bit waiting for this trailer of buffalo to show up. And they were all standing outside when we got there, and we hop out, throw the cameras on and meet them out in this pasture. They were singing the song with this drum, and all these young men were in a circle and they were talking with one another about what it all meant for them to see this, watching them, how emotional they were becoming of this moment, and then opening up that trailer and the sound of those hooves. They just came running off. They just came busting out and just ran straight out into this tree line. And it was just so beautiful. And I was just looking around at all the spectators and everybody was just in tears. And Menominee haven't had buffalo up on that land for over 200 years. So it was a really, really big deal. And it kind of, those moments where it kind of hits you and you're like, wow, I'm watching history.
That's cool. That gave me a little bit of chills just hearing that description. And for you, Juliana, what was your path into storytelling and directing, and what kind of stories do you feel artistically or creatively motivated by?
All my films have been about Native stories, and I am really interested in history. I've always been kind of geared towards a history story, but I appreciate the contemporary angle and how we can learn from, say, our mistakes, or maybe the things that we got right. And so when it comes to Native stories, there's just no shortage of them. There's so many. I mean, just so many. We've got hundreds and hundreds of years to make up. I think a lot of communities were very private and reticent to share anything because of historic traumas. Nowadays, I think people are seeing the value in sharing those stories because we become less invisible. And because we have so much to offer the world, not just our communities, I think if people were to really pay attention to what we've been saying all along about our environment and how to live in the natural world, then we'd probably be in a different place today.
Yeah, looking forward, what do you think this process of returning bison to Indigenous lands might look like in 10, 20, or 50 years down the road? And what makes you hopeful in this space?
For my tribe, I would hope that we have a decent sized herd and we completely erase beef from our diet, and that we can bring back some of our old traditions. For our tribe to be able to buy back more land would be to be able to house a good amount of buffalo, sustain our community, possibly to be able to even trade or sell with other communities. Our health in my tribe it really needs attention. And I think a lot of the younger kids are kind of put off by the idea of buffalo because it's different. It's so different for them. But I think once they taste it, they're going to realize like it tastes even better. You feel good after you eat it. I would really like to see my tribe do a lot more with food sovereignty. And I think buffalo is the perfect place to start.
Juliana Branham is a documentary filmmaker and the director of the new film Homecoming. Juliana, thank you so much for being here today and for sharing your thoughts and perspectives and for sharing this story out with a bigger audience. I'm excited for people to give it a watch.
Thank you so much for having me.
There's a new mural on Jackson Bike's path honoring Northern Arapaho tribal members. Students from the Wind River Reservation worked with an artist and language teacher to make a piece that depicts the four hills of life. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Hannah Merzbach reports.
Around 50 students, part of Wyoming's Northern Arapaho tribe, crowd together on Jackson's bike path as they prepare for the ribbon cutting. They're next to the Garamond Tunnel, the home of the colorful 80-foot-long mural.
Say it with me. Yenne.
Arapaho language teacher Lorraine Goggles is having the students go through the four hills of life, the subject of the mural they helped create.
So that's the four hills of life. In our culture, it's everything, you know, it's our life.
Wind River artist Colleen Friday worked with the students from elementary to high school age to come up with the idea for the mural and use paint by numbers to fill it in. She says the students initially drew water, mountains, and buffalo in a brainstorming session.
So through that, I meshed our culture, our Arapaho identity to share with this community.
Friday says depicting the four hills of life made sense because it includes all the students' ideas. Mountains and rivers run throughout the piece. The first section, the first hill of life, includes a buffalo calf and cow. Friday says it represents childhood and birth, or the spring season, while the second hill represents youth, or summer.
Like getting out and gathering food and getting ready to go into fall in the end of the year.
The colors darken as the mural moves into fall, or adulthood.
It's like learning to speak up and give back to your community and people.
The fourth hill represents winter, but also the culture of storytelling. An elder is shown sitting with a cane, speaking to the silhouettes of children. It's a realistic painting of an Arapaho elder who taught the native language and oral history to youth.
What's humbling to me is my dad is in the artwork.
That's the elder's son, Pat Moss, who's also at the celebration. He's the chairman of Fremont County School Board and came to support the students, but says he was taken aback when he saw his father was included in the mural, which he says shows the Northern Arapaho way.
And it will be shared now with everyone in the community and those who walk this path.
The mural was made in collaboration with Jackson Hole Community Pathways and Jackson Hole Public Art, which are trying to make the bike path not just a means of transportation, but a place in the community. Mayor Haley Morton Levinson says she encourages having art in public locations like this.
I walk or bike this path often with my family, and being able to enjoy this art and kind of think about that on my regular dog walk is a really special thing.
Students from Jackson Hole High School also were there to learn about the mural and act as local ambassadors for the art piece. Some of them worked on the mural on the other side of the Garamond Tunnel. That one represents Mexican culture, highlighting parts of Tlaxcala, the Mexican state where many in the community have roots.
We have a lot of different pieces of culture that maybe haven't always been highlighted, and it's really important to me to have them highlighted so that we all know about those cultures. All these folks are part of our community.
Bikes whiz by and dogs bark as Morton Levinson prepares to cut a ribbon, celebrating the new mural. She encourages the kids to come help her. Together, they hold big blue scissors around the red and white ribbon.
All right, 3, 2, 1. Yay!
And with that, the kids disperse, some taking in the new mural, others playing by the nearby flat creek under the changing yellow trees. Their Arapaho teacher, Lorraine Goggles, says this is a big moment for them.
Look, they're all happy, they're all smiling, and they know which parts they did. It'll be a memory for them for a long time. So, aho.
Meaning, thank you, in Arapaho. Hannah Mersbach, KHOL News.
You might not know that there are competitions for herding dogs. There are. Up next, we join in on one. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadalska. Many of the best herding dogs in North America were in our region recently for the National Sheepdog Final. The competitors, all border collies, worked with their handlers to herd some stubborn sheep. Aspen Public Radio's Caroline Yanez has this report for the Mountain West News Bureau.
The dogs and their handlers gathered on a crisp fall morning at the String Ranch. Mountains loomed over the open pasture that serves as the trial course. Their challenge? Ornery range sheep from Colorado's high country and miles of field to run them on. Their handlers use a series of whistled and verbal commands to tell the dogs where to go and what to do. But a lot of the sport starts with instinct, and the Border Collie's innate desire to work the sheep is on full display here.
They know what to do. It's just building the communication system between the two of you and developing them and correcting the bad little bits, trimming them off, and saying, no, no, doggy, don't do that.
That's Ellen Skillings from California. She's been in this sport, also called dog trialing, and working with animals for nearly 40 years. Skillings says the competition at the Western Colorado Ranch highlights a bond between the handler and the dog that can only be built with dedication and hard work.
And this is a big course with pretty tough sheep, and so the dogs really has to have a lot of stamina to get through it. It requires quite a lot of dog.
The course and the tasks reflect actual farm work with livestock. For example, a good stock dog must be able to herd stock over long distances. That's especially true in the West, where ranges stretch miles and predators like wolves and coyotes are abundant. Or if a sheep is sick, a dog needs to help its handler separate it from the rest of the herd. And of course, any herding dog needs to help get sheep into a pen. Among the competitors here is Bridget Strang, whose family owns and runs the ranch, and her dog, Bill. The pair have competed in trials all over the country, but Bill's main job is helping out on the ranch.
That's kind of how I train them. I teach them a few tools, and then I go out and I do a job.
You might think Bill would have a home field advantage, but he's only 3 years old, and he hasn't worked with these sheep before. For Strang, hosting the national finals is a special experience.
You know, I live for the dog trialing. I would still have dogs and sheep and do the work if I didn't dog trial. But with every job I do, I sort of have my eye on the ball for how that might help me in the trial field.
In the semifinals, Strang and Bill were able to corral all of their sheep into the pen. But they missed a set of panel gates, an opening in a fence which the dog must guide its sheep through. They also had trouble shedding or separating two sheep off from the group.
I mishandled it. I misread that panel, so I missed that panel. And then I made a mistake in the shedding ring.
In the end, their score didn't qualify the duo for the finals. Though Strang felt satisfied with the results because Bill was in his first national finals and has many more years ahead of him. The competition's winners were Scott Glenn and 4-year-old Pip from Alberta, Canada.
Hey, come by. Hi.
Even for a seasoned winner like Glenn, it's breathtaking to watch the dogs work.
It always stuck with me how neat it was the dog knew left and right. That always impressed me because we had cattle dogs, but I mean, it was sick 'em or come back, hopefully.
Glenn brought home tens of thousands of dollars from the prize purse. But the reward for Pip, Bill, and all the other dogs who had been sprinting for miles was to cool down by taking a plunge in big buckets of cool water. Next season, there will also be plenty of newcomers, like Skilling's pup Freyer, who's not yet won. For all of Skilling's experience, she can't say what next season will bring.
It's never the same. You're never done training and thinking about it. The more you do, the more questions you ask. I think it's never boring.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Caroline Yanez in Carbondale, Colorado.
Mike Rowe of the Discovery Channel's Dirty Job fame stopped by Casper College recently. Rowe focuses on trade jobs like welding or electricians, rather than the four-year college path. Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger spoke with Mike Rowe about his foundation, the state of jobs, and the meaning of work.
So, not that you require any introduction, but can you go ahead and let the folks in Wyoming know who you are?
So, my name is Mike Rowe, and I am the CEO of the Mike Rowe Works Foundation and a sort of TV host, I guess, and sometimes narrator, I suppose, an occasional spokesman, and from time to time, a writer, and this sounds weird, but a recording artist, I guess.
Oh, are you jumping into the music industry?
I wouldn't say jumping. I've always been sort of around it, but I recorded a song a couple years ago as a fundraiser for my foundation called Santa's Got a Dirty Job with John Rich, and it wound up going to number one. So I've been getting these crazy calls from all kinds of people in Nashville and in the music business, asking if I'm going to do an album, which I have no plans to do. But hey, never say never.
Well, I guess it just goes to your kind of title as a jack of all trades. But you were
Remember the totality of that phrase: jack of all trades, master of none. So, yeah. Paid to try. That's my thing.
But going back to Wyoming, you were recently at Casper College. Can you tell us what you were stopping by the Cowboy State for?
I was invited to talk about work. And it's something that I do a fair amount of these days. Dirty Jobs is still on the air. And I think that, you know, that's kind of burned me into the collective retina of our country, and the work I do with my foundation has given me a certain amount of permission to talk about things like the cost of college and the upside of pursuing a skilled trade. And I get invited all over the place to talk about those things. And somebody from Wyoming reached out, and how could I say no to Wyoming? It's one of my favorite places.
Well, let's talk about that foundation a little more. You're on a mission to change the narrative around work. Can you tell us where this mission kind of started?
Years ago, higher education needed better PR. We genuinely needed more people getting into the humanities and exploring careers in engineering and medicine and so forth. And so we began to promote those careers. But like most PR, we went too far. And we didn't simply promote the benefits of a four-year degree on its merits. We positioned all other forms of education as subordinate to the four-year path. And at the same time, we took shop class out of high school. And I think the combination of those things sent a pretty clear message to a whole generation of kids. And that created a kind of disconnect, I think. And the results of that disconnect today are a few hundred million people who don't really understand where their energy comes from or where their food comes from or what it takes to build a home. So my foundation tries to challenge the lunacy of that kind of thinking.
While we're talking about redefining narratives around work, let's talk about the nature of work. There's a discussion to be had about whether modern work is just a means to an end and people are paid correctly for their labor, or if modern work is a way for people to find themselves and grow and develop their character. Do you lean in any one way or the other, or maybe think it's a mixture of both?
Look, that's only the question of our times, right? You're asking not about job satisfaction, you're asking about life satisfaction. And there's not a playbook for that. And I'm not sure who's listening to this, but I hesitate to give specific advice because one person might need to hear something really, really, really different. Look, speaking only for myself, I didn't care at all about the meaning of the work I did. I took great pleasure in not caring about the quality of the infomercial or the 8 years I spent in the Baltimore Opera dressed up like a pirate or a Viking singing words in another language that I didn't even understand. You know, I didn't try to extract any purpose or meaning except to have a good time and do the very best work I could in the scope of that job. That's how I thought, and that's what I did for the first 20 years. The last 20 years have been really different. Dirty jobs was a mistake. It was a happy accident. It was supposed to be a three-pilot show that came and went, but it hit a chord. And I suddenly realized, wow, this is new. This is different. And I thought, you know what? This is a job I can take seriously. And this is a job maybe that'll provide a level of meaning or significance that I hadn't had before. And the good news is I was right. The bad news is it exacts a hell of a toll. You know, I spent the next 10 years on the road, crawling through sewers and artificially inseminating all creatures great and small and on the receiving end of God knows how many exploding toilets. It was a fun show. It was a hard show. And it was an honest show. We never did a second take, right? We showed America what work looked like through the eyes of a middle-aged apprentice.
So moving from dirty jobs to just the state of jobs in this country, you often reference a book by Nicholas Eberstadt called Men Without Work. And in that book, he talks about how there's 4 million new jobs post-pandemic and 4 million fewer workers post-pandemic as well. A lot of people have given you their solutions and theories to why this is and how to solve it. But I'm curious if you think the constant obsession with getting new jobs out into the market maybe overlooks the quality or goodness of those jobs, and if that's maybe something we can look at or review.
So, yeah, there's always room for an argument about working conditions and job quality, and I'm all for people having that within the context of their work. But to me, speaking broadly, the conversation is about the existence of opportunity. Period. So, you know, when I quote Nick and his book, I do it mainly in the context of, I think a lot of people came to the conclusion that opportunity was dead and they just gave up. And a lot of those people, unfortunately, are men in their prime working years. The stat that Nick really got my attention with is 7.2 million able-bodied men who are not only not working, but aren't looking for work. And that's never happened before in this country, not in peacetime anyway. They're not only not working, they're not engaged in their community. They're not volunteering. You know, that worries me. And the fact that there are nearly 11 million open positions right now, most of which don't require a four-year degree, that worries me. $1.7 trillion in student loans on the books worries me. But what scares me is this still steady drumbeat of people saying, look, if you don't take that path, you're screwed. I object to that, you know, and my foundation objects to that because I think those perceptions are a result of a lot of broad brush painting. So we're here to confront some of those stereotypes good-naturedly and debunk them if we can.
Well, Mr. Rowe, I just want to say thank you for taking time to answer all the questions, and I hope that your visit to Wyoming or any visit to Wyoming in the future is a good one.
I've never had a bad time in Wyoming. I had a weird time, but never a bad one.
I hope it's another not bad one then. Thank you again, Mr. Rowe.
Anytime. I appreciate it.
To close out our show, we hear a special preview of the newest season of our award-winning podcast, The Modern West. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Camila Kadelska. The Modern West podcast just released the trailer for their new series. The Burn Scar tells the story of Ariel Lavery, how her parents were evacuated, and how her family lost their home in the Marshall Fire. That's the urban wildfire that burned into the suburbs of Boulder, Colorado, in the middle of winter in 2021. The Modern West host, Melody Edwards, spoke with Lavery about why she decided to produce a podcast about this devastating event. Edwards starts by asking what made the Marshall Fire so unusual.
This fire was the very first time we had ever seen an urban fire, an urban wildfire in Colorado. Colorado had never seen anything like this before, and people who'd lived here for a long time were well acquainted with wildfire, I think, for a lot of people, sort of in concept only, or, you know, just from images that they saw through the media. And suddenly there was a wildfire that was burning through suburban neighborhoods in a very heavily populated area of the Front Range. So that was the first thing that made this fire so remarkable. And seeing those images on the television screens where I saw it from my hotel room in the middle of Kansas, I think was also just incredibly arresting. The media grabbed onto it right away, I think, because these images were so remarkable and disturbing to see. These were homes in an affluent area, you know, large homes, you know, people who had never imagined that they would be experiencing something like this.
In episode one, your parents are evacuating. And like you mentioned, you're in the hotel and kind of stuck there because of a freak ice storm. And I wonder if you can talk just a little bit about, you know, that combination and what that felt like to your family in that moment, because it does seem just like such a crazy coincidence.
Yeah. So I can't say, because I haven't looked at the science about that ice storm, if that was directly connected to human-caused climate change, the way that I discuss in the episode that the Marshall Fire was. But I can say that there was a realization the day after we all woke up and we sort of knew that my parents' house was gone. They were staying in a friend's basement in Boulder. We knew that they were now refugees. My husband and I had a conversation not long after that about the weather that was moving through where we were in Missouri, in Columbia, Missouri, that we should probably stay put, because if we were to get on the road in that moment, we might be facing some severe weather that could put us at risk, at further risk. And so I was thinking, okay, my parents are staying in their friend's basement in Boulder. We are facing the choice of having to stay in this hotel room. And although we were safe, it definitely brought my mind to an imagining of the future and thinking, is this kind of what I need to prepare for, to be experiencing more and more? Is this what it's going to feel like to be a climate refugee? I know that people all over the world are going to have different experiences of climate change, but in this country, we're probably going to be seeing people having to live out of their cars, be more mobile, be more specific in their choices about where they live, not because it's a pretty area or because they like the people that are there, but they're going to have to be thinking about what the weather conditions and what the seasonal conditions are going to be there.
I think one of the parts of the series that affected me the most is when you talk about being homesick for a place that is gone. I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about that feeling and also how it relates to kind of the overall, the larger themes of the whole series.
Yeah. So the feeling that you're talking about is called solastalgia, and it was a term that was coined by Glenn Albrecht, who's an Australian philosopher. And he kind of came up with this term, you know, thinking a lot about a primary example of people in Appalachia, small communities in Appalachia, who witnessed their mountaintops destroyed for mining, you know, the strip mining that was going on there, which also provided their main source of income eventually. You know, those communities were sort of reorganized around the industry, but it doesn't mean that those people were any less sad or affected to see their environments destroyed that way. I had what I think is solastalgia. I mean, I don't I haven't talked with Glenn Albrecht, so I don't know if it's okay to deem this experience solastalgia or not, but I had a feeling of that when I visited the site with my mom 4 months after the fire in April for the first time. I flew back out there because I wanted to help my parents, and I also just felt like I needed to see the site. I needed to see the neighborhood. As I say in the series, I'm one of those people who needs to see the dead body for it to be real. I noticed when I was on the site that the house finches were still there singing their song. Our neighborhood and the city of Louisville is in the flight path of DIA traffic, so we would always hear the jet planes roaring overhead. That was still there. It was a really strange feeling because I felt like I was in a place I'd never seen before. The smell, I'd never smelled anything like that. But then I suddenly recognized where I was because of the sounds. And that was a really strange feeling. And it wasn't until maybe a year later that I came across the term solastalgia. And I immediately was brought back to that moment and thinking, this is describing what that experience is. It's gotta be. And I think it's an important term to understand because, and to start using in our common parlance, because probably more people are gonna be experiencing things like this as the climate changes so quickly.
What are some of the hard decisions that your family has been forced to make as you've been recovering from losing your home in this fire?
So the first decision my parents had to make was where they were going to live. They had a pretty good coverage with their insurance, so they were able to get a payout without having to fill out an entire inventory. So they were able to start living on that payout. Their insurance also gave them living allowances, but they ended up retreating to and staying with friends in Boulder in their basement for the first couple nights. And then they relocated to another of my mom's friends. And my mom was thinking, well, maybe we can just stay at this person's house and we can pay her rent and just live here. Because I think when something like this happens, suddenly your whole world is upside down and you're questioning, should we even be living in this landscape? I mean, clearly it's not safe. So the question of where to live was the biggest decision they had to make initially. And my parents are elderly. My dad has Lewy body dementia, so my mom is his caretaker. She started going back and forth about whether or not they should move into senior living. There was an apartment that was available in a senior housing facility. She was really not keen on having to move in there. Eventually, they decided to move in because of my dad's condition, and mom thought it would probably be better for him to be in that community in a place where he would likely be safer and they would be taken care of in terms of meals and cleaning help and things like that. It wasn't until sometime later that my mom made the decision to rebuild.
I wonder, just to wrap up, if you could talk a little bit about just how you made this podcast. You started collecting the audio for it right away, as soon as the fire happened. Can you talk just a little bit about the process of making the podcast?
Sure. So I had actually been recording Zoom conversations with my parents for a while, because when my dad was first diagnosed with Lewy body dementia, I thought, I need to document. I just really like documenting things. So I was already recording Zoom audio. And then when this fire happened, you know, those recordings were happening. We had several that were scheduled regularly. And when I was out there in April, I brought my Zoom recorder with me there. Again, it was just this impulse of needing to record. I had no concept that I was going to be pitching this as a story idea to any podcast. I just needed to record this. I needed to somehow remember the feelings of, you know, visiting the site and being there. And it was on one of the days I was taking a shower in Colorado in April, after I had visited the site the first time, that I thought, I really should probably pitch this. And I immediately thought about you, and I thought about the modern West. And the rest is history, I suppose. Once you know you're producing a series, then you just record everything you possibly can.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards speaking with podcast producer Ariel Lavery about their new Modern West series, The Burn Scar. You can listen to the new trailer at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. The show can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Melody Edwards, our producer, and Ivy Engel, our digital producer and social media manager for today's show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.